Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. So is the economy freaking out or just the economic press? In just a minute, we'll ask a guest who writes about both. But if you've been following the news lately, you've been hearing a lot about rumblings of a recession, right? Take, for example, on this very radio station, the opening of last night's Marketplace, in which the host, Kai Ryssdal, started the show with this checklist of warning signs.
Declining business investment, number one. Slowing economic growth overall, GDP, number two. That inverted yield curve we mentioned last week, number three. Global weakness, number four. I think you get my point.
I get your point. Hi, Kai. And Kai didn't even mention there two of the things that I've been hearing repeated most often in the last few days. The stock market's recent volatility, including the 800-point Dow drop last Wednesday, and the survey last week of more than 200 economists done by the National Association for Business Economics, in which 38% of the respondents predicted a recession for next year. How many times have you heard that 38% stat in the last few days and see it framed as an ominous sign, both for the economy and for Donald Trump in his reelection year? But wait, if 38% think we will enter a recession by next year, doesn't that mean 62% think we won't? So how should that story really be written? I'm confused. That's why we called our first guest, Dean Baker, the dean of liberal economists following the money and the media that cover it. He is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He is the author of several books, including Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People, The End of Loser Liberalism, Social Security, The Phony Crisis, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also has a blog, Beat the Press, where he specifically discusses the media's coverage of economic issues. So we'll talk about all of this. And we will add one other big news item this week, or is it a big news item? As the New York Times put it in their lead sentence on the matter, nearly 200 chief executives, including the leaders of Apple, Pepsi, and Walmart, tried on Monday to redefine the role of business in society. Whoa, redefine the role of business in society. Milton Friedman must be going restless in his free market grave, but spoiler alert, Dean Baker is skeptical. Dean, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me on, Brian.
Let's hold the Fortune 500 companies trying to redefine the role of business in society away from merely shareholders for the second half and start with a list of things that point toward a downturn. 38% of the economists in that NABE survey predict a recession for next year, big news-making stat. But as I said, that means 62% of economists are not predicting a recession by then. What should a confused kid from Queens make of those numbers? And for good measure, what's your own prediction about that?
Yeah, well, economists tend to be kind of herd-like in their thinking. So 38% means that is a high number, because most times, if you polled economists this time last year, the year before, I don't know, 5, 10, 15%. I mean, there's always some economists who are going to say a recession's around the corner. So that is more than usual. And to be fair, there are, you know, the signs you mentioned, they're definitely negative signs on the economy. But having looked at it closely, I just don't see a recession story. I do see a story of weaker growth, and I don't mean to be picky here, but the distinction is a recession actually means the economy goes into reverse, that we see two quarters at least of negative growth, and it can mean large rises in unemployment, a really bad story. Slower growth means, as you could imagine, less job creation. It could mean that we start to see the unemployment rate rise. It means a weaker labor market. That's also a bad story, but not quite as bad. And when I look at the data closely, I think we're much more likely to see the latter, a story where the economy slows down. I don't mean just 3% to 2%. That's already happened, but perhaps as low as 1%, even 0.5%. But we will probably still see positive growth And my main reason for saying that is that historically, when you look at the recessions we've had, the big fall-offs have come in housing construction and car buying, obvious reasons. People don't buy a house when they're worried about losing their job and they're bad times. And car buying, again, same thing. You don't want to commit yourself to a big car loan. I'm less concerned about that today for a simple reason. Housing construction is already fairly low. So you can go, it could fall lower, but you just go, how much? We can't have, this isn't 2008, 2009, where there was a huge fall in construction because we'd had this massive boom. You don't have that. And in terms of car buying, that could fall off. We've had high rates of car buying. They probably will fall off. But it just matters much less to the economy today than it did in the past, both because autos are a smaller share of the economy, but probably more importantly, it says it's good or bad, but it's the reality, a much larger share of our cars, both the cars themselves and the parts, are imported. So when you look at that, I just don't see the ingredients for a recession. So I think people have been a little bit, and people, meaning economists here, have been a little misled on this.
And I get the distinction that you're making between a recession where the economy, the total output of the economy actually shrinks, and slower growth where it goes from maybe 2 or 3% where we've been down to like 1%. Who gets hurt in that scenario? From, if we're just going from 2% growth to 1% growth, and, you know, the economics press and the political press have been framing this potential slowdown as a big threat to Donald Trump's reelection because suddenly people won't feel as flush as they feel today, to the extent that they feel flush. Who actually gets hurt?
Well, it really, you know, to my mind, really is the story of the labor market. And with 1% growth, we're probably telling a story where we start to see the unemployment rate inch higher. So it's not that we're suddenly going to jump up to 6 or 7 or 8% unemployment, but we've had obviously a very low rate, at least by historical standards, 3.7%. So we might start to see that inch higher, inch over 4 or 4.5, hard to say an exact number, but you know, see it inch somewhat higher. And that's important both obviously because people can't find work, but even more importantly, that means a weaker labor market. And we've been seeing modest wage growth over the last 3 or 4 years. So wages have been growing roughly a percentage point more than the inflation rate. So that's not a great story, but that means workers are gaining. So that's what you want to see. I mean, it'd be great if it weren't half, 2 percentage points, but whatever, 1 percentage point, you know, give or take a little bit, that's at least going in the right direction. And what I worry is that if the labor market starts to weaken, then you'll see slower wage growth, and that means workers won't be making progress. Maybe they'll just be treading water. And, of course, those are averages. So if we say on average today that wage growth is 1% more than prices, 1 percentage point more than prices, some are getting 2, some are getting 3, some are just treading water. But if that average goes to 0, that means, sure, some are still doing okay, some are still coming out ahead, but that means some people are falling behind. And it tends to be, in a weaker labor market, those who fall behind are those at the bottom, the more likely African-Americans, Hispanics, people with less education, people with criminal records. I mean, one of the great stories, I don't think it's gotten enough attention, but one of the great stories is you've gotten low unemployment rate, a lot of firms that might otherwise have done so are hiring people with criminal records because they need workers. And if you have someone who comes there, they're willing to work and they have a criminal record, they're going, well, whatever, we're going to hire you. That doesn't happen when the labor market weakens.
Listeners, want to invite you in on at least two tracks here. One, is the economy freaking out or just the economic press? What do you think? And on this other story that we're about to get into, if you own a business or you own stock, what is your investment for? There's a story about 200 leading CEOs, including the CEOs of Walmart and Apple and PepsiCo, saying, we're not going to be just for our shareholders anymore. We're going to be more in the public interest. So listeners, for you, if you own a business or you own a stock, what is your investment for? Do you think about maximizing happiness for the employees, for the environment, for the customers? Or is the greatest good for your shareholder value, if it's a public company, just so you can have more money to spend? Remember, we heard how consumer spending drives the economy these days, and help your fellow humans just in that way. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or ask Dean Baker anything at 212-433-9692. As this founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research is explaining some of the economic reporting to us from these last few weeks. 212-433-9692. Let's go to that part two story. Maybe we'll cycle back to some economic fundamentals as well. But the announcement by about 200 leading CEOs that shareholder value has become too much of a single focus in American companies, or as the New York Times report on their statement read, quote, breaking with decades of long-held corporate orthodoxy, the Business Roundtable issued a statement on the purpose of a corporation, arguing that companies should no longer advance only the interests of shareholders. Instead, the group said, they must also invest in their employees, protect the environment, and deal fairly and ethically with their suppliers. Quote, while each of our individual companies serves its own corporate purpose, we share a fundamental commitment to all of our stakeholders, unquote. And it says, we commit to deliver value to all of them for the future success of our companies, our communities, and our country, unquote. Though the Times notes that this Business Roundtable is a lobbying organization that represents these large companies. So, Dean, I saw you tweet about this, so I know your BS detector is going bing, 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 bing. What's your reaction?
Well, you know, first off, sure, I'd love to see companies be more respectful to their workers, care about the environment and the community. Those are all good values. But what I really took issue with is this idea that they've been committed to shareholder return as the first and primary goal, because simple reality is shareholder return over the last two decades has actually been pretty low by historical standards. I don't want to get into argue what they should get. I'm just saying by historical standards. Mm-hmm. So if you go back, and I chose December 1997 to avoid the distortions of the stock bubble in the 90s, the average return over that period has been just 4.8% a year. That's adjusted for inflation. That compares to historic return of over 7%. So if their goal has been maximizing shareholder value, they've been doing a really bad job of it.
But let me jump in on that as the confused kid from Queens and tell you something else that I don't understand. And it comes from that analysis. I thought one of the major inequities in the economy in the last few decades has been the stock market keeps going up. Yes, it goes in cycles. It goes down. It crashed during the financial crisis, et cetera. But long-term trend, the stock market keeps going up so much faster than people's wages, which indicates a redistribution of wealth from worker to owner. And so shareholders are actually doing, by that telling, better than they should be as a reflection of the overall economy.
Well, there's a couple things. First off, you have to look in percentage terms. So if you hear the market went up, it depends what you're looking at, say the Dow Jones Industrial Average, you hear went up 100 points today. That sounds like a lot. Well, the Dow Jones, I'd have to look where it is exactly, but somewhere around 25,000. So that means that's about 0.4%. So not trivial, but that's not that huge. On the other hand, if it went up 100 points, say 30 years ago when it was somewhere around 2,000, well, that was a really big deal. You know, so part of it is, I think that's a little bit of a distortion. But the other thing to keep in mind, and people often miss this, shareholders get returns two avenues. One is through the rise in stock prices. The other is dividends. And it used to be the case, dividends actually were a larger source of return to shareholders than the rise in stock prices. So it used to be that dividends were typically 4-5% of the share price. Today they're around 1%. So people, you know, and I don't blame someone who's just, you know, grabbing the newspaper or whatever, but, you know, economists, writers on economic issues, we should be making that point clear. And again, I'm not going to shed any tears for stockholders. I know that for the most part, they're the wealthiest people in the country, or I should say disproportionately stock is held by the wealthiest people in the country. So I know that they're wealthier, but I'm just saying, just as a matter of returns, and it's a very simple calculation, that their returns have been considerably lower on average in the last two decades than in prior periods. So again, it's not a question of whether I think their returns are too high or too low. I mean, I'm happy to argue one way or the other, but mm-hmm. but the point is, just the simple fact is their returns have been historically low over the last two decades.
So one more question on this before we go to the phones on the various things we've been talking about. The group includes the CEOs of Apple, Walmart, Pepsi, JP Morgan Chase, for heaven's sakes, giving them the benefit of the doubt for a minute that they're not simply blowing public relations smoke, that they at least feel conflicted about something in a new way recently, or just tell me I shouldn't even be, you know, asking the question in those terms. But what might that be, if you can go there at all?
Well, clearly they're responding to public pressure. But the other point I was going to make in terms of where the money's been going, it's been going to them. So CEO pay has risen by almost 1,000% over the last four decades. That's adjusting for inflation. We all know there's been inflation. But it used to be the case that a typical CEO got 20 to 30 times the pay of a typical worker. Currently, it's on the order of 200 times. So if these guys, they're mostly guys, they want to fix things, how about starting with themselves instead of getting paychecks? Jamie Dimon, who was the leader of this group, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, he gets over $20 million a year. How about if he got $2 million a year? He'd still be doing pretty well, but that's what he would have been getting if you go back 40 years and go, where were CEOs? What would they have been getting? He'd be getting around $2 million a year. Maybe you'd have to struggle to live on that. I don't know. But, you know, that would be a really good place to start. And I emphasize the CEO pay. It's not just the small number of CEOs. I know there aren't that many of them. But if you have a CEO getting $20 million, odds are the chief financial officer, the other, you know, four or five top executives, they're getting $10 million. And then you go down the next layer, they're getting $1 or $2 million. And it's simple arithmetic. More money it goes to those at the top, less for those at the bottom. So I would, if they want to be good citizens of society, how about start with a little honesty and look in the mirror? And that was what my real frustration was with that statement.
All right. Let's take a phone call. Maybe this is an anecdotal economic indicator from Mike in Sayville. You're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I think we're going to have a really bad recession, and I think it's going to last a long time. And for a couple of reasons. One, I saw it coming in 2008. I'm not a genius, but I was in business and I saw it coming. I sold my business and got a safe state job. And the stock market is, in my opinion, bogus for three reasons. One, the government's putting a gun to your head. You can't get any kind of return on any kind of money other than put in stocks. The rates are so low that it's either the stock market or nothing. Two, most of corporate America is getting paid by stock options, not salary. So they're only paying capital gains tax. They're not paying personal income tax. Their only incentive is to pump up the stock so that they can cash out, take the money, and leave somebody else holding the bag. That's why I heard the gentleman talk about dividends. Mm-hmm. They don't pay dividends anymore. They want to get the stock prices up so they can get their money.
Mike, thank you so much for that. So, Dean Baker, to Mike's point, and he made several there, but to, I think, what is a central point, you know, in Kai Ryssdal's list of economic warning signs that we played at the beginning, the one that seems to be the biggest cause of people freaking out is what he called the inverted yield curve. And Mike, our caller from Sayville, talks about the low interest rates. The inverted yield curve, as you know, means short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates. So can you explain to the confused kid from Queens and everyone else why that would ever happen? Because typically if we lend people money for a longer time, like buying a five-year CD from a bank rather than a one-year, it'll pay a higher interest rate for the privilege of holding your money longer. So what's an inverted yield curve and what does it tell us?
Yeah, so an inverted yield curve, as you said, is when the long-term rates fall below the short-term rates. And the one that people are focused on, because you could obviously look at different interest rates, is that the interest rate on 10-year Treasury bonds fell below the interest rate on 2-year Treasury notes. That happened early last week, and I don't follow the markets that closely, so it might have happened again a couple times. But the last I looked, the interest rate on 10-year Treasury bonds was about 1.58, and on 2-year Treasury notes, I think it was 1.54. So they've been close, but they had inverted, so the 10-year Treasury yield was somewhat lower. And that means, you know, kind of just at the most simple level, why would I ever agree to accept a lower interest rate on a 10-year Treasury bond than on a 2-year Treasury note? Well, if I think that interest rates will be lower in the future, so I might be happy to lock in a 1.5% interest rate over the next 10 years if I think that next year, the year after that, the interest rate, short-term interest rate, is just going to be 1% or 0.5%, whatever it might be. So the story story most immediately of an inverted yield curve is that people expect lower interest rates in the future. And to my guess, that's probably a reasonable expectation because the Federal Reserve Board is likely to lower short-term interest rates again, probably at their next meeting, and they might do it two times this year. Not inconceivable they'll do it three. I mean, President Trump, of course, is yelling at them to lower it a full full percentage point. I'm quite certain they won't do that. But in any case, it is likely they'll lower rates. So that's the basic story. They anticipate lower rates in the future. Now, historically, that has been associated with a recession.
Just to throw in this historical context, then, you know, Mike from Sayville, the caller who sees these low interest rates and says he's seeing things now that remind him of 2007. The last time there was an inverted yield curve in the bond markets was 2007, which was basically 10 minutes before the financial crisis.
Yeah, well, a couple points here. One is that you get an inverted yield curve typically because the Fed is raising interest rates. And so that's pushing up short-term rates. And at some point, you know, the markets start betting, going, well, they aren't going to keep doing this. So why don't I lock in a long-term interest rate? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at some point in the future, of course, the Fed will turn around and stop raising rates. So most of our recessions have been caused by the Fed raising short-term rates. Not that they've been evil people trying to bring on a recession. What they've been trying to do is slow the economy because they're worried about inflation. So that's the typical story, and that's why it's generally been associated with it. Now, in 2007, 2008, I was following it too. I think I was probably on your show a couple times. There was a huge housing bubble. And that was going to end because it didn't make sense. It was a bubbles burst, and that was the story there. And I was referring a moment ago to the fact that housing is not that large a share of the economy now. It's about 3.7% of the economy. If you go back to 2007, it was about 6.5% of the economy. So it had a long way to go down. 3.7%. I'm not saying it can't fall from there, but it can't fall that much from there. Whereas, you know, again, going back to 2007, it fell below 2%. So we had a drop of about 4.5 percentage points of the economy just in housing. So I just don't see that same story, which, again, isn't to say that everything's, you know, all sunny. It's just that I don't see a disaster story out ahead.
Amanda in Nassau County. You're on WNYC. Hi, Amanda.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Amanda.
You have a question?
Yes, and it's kind of more like advice. My husband and I are first-time home buyers. We're in Nassau County. Nassau County is it's so expensive. It's insane how expensive Nassau County is. And every time we are looking at houses, I have this feeling of an ever-looming like recession over me. And I just don't know if this is the right time to buy a house. I feel like every time we look at houses and put in a bid, I end up withdrawing it because I hear, oh, there's a recession coming. And I just feel like, is this a good time? I'm just, like, so scared to get into a mortgage and then a big recession happens like it did in 2008.
You mean like you and your husband might lose your jobs?
Exactly, lose our jobs and go, and like, the whole 2008 all over again, like, and lose our jobs, unable to pay our mortgage, and I'm just so scared that it's going to happen the moment, because it sounds like it's going to happen any moment now. Like, listening to the news, everyone's saying a recession's coming.
And there we are again with Amanda listening to the news, Dean, and hearing, oh, a recession's coming. And so you hear it, she and her husband getting ready to hopefully be first-time home buyers. Too worried that they're going to lose their jobs. I realize you're a macroeconomist. You're not a financial advisor. But what would you say to Amanda?
Well, there's a few simple things. First off, you have to look very carefully. How secure are your jobs? I feel very confident in saying we're not going to have a 2008-2009 type recession. So even if I'm wrong on the recession story, I don't see the sort of disaster that we had 2008, 2009. Just to be clear, I was warning of that sort of disaster, so it's not that I was blindsided for it. I was warning about it. I was saying we get a recession, could be a really bad one. So it's not that I'm always, you know, seeing the bright side of everything. But we could well have a recession. Even if we don't have a recession, we could have slower growth, as I was saying, which could mean a weaker labor market. So think very carefully. You know, what does your job look like? What's your employment situation? Are you vulnerable? So that's the first question. Second question, interest rates are very low. So that does make it an attractive time to buy a house, or people have a house if they have a mortgage to refinance a mortgage. So that doesn't mean they can't go lower. I mean, they certainly can, but just by historic standards, these are very low mortgage interest rates. So that makes it attractive. Third point, what's the direction of house prices? And that's a very big issue. The one thing I'll say, because I'm not going to speak as any sort of expert on the housing market in Nassau or really anywhere else, but I just will say we don't have the sort of inflated house prices we had back in 2006, 2007, because I tell people then, you know, unless you really love this place, it's probably not a good idea to buy it. And I wouldn't say that today, which doesn't mean that we couldn't have a story where a year out, 2 years out, house prices are 5% or 10% lower. But back then, we had house prices. Prices fall by 30, 40, even 50% in some places. I have a hard time seeing that.
Amanda, good luck. And if there's one thing to take away from what Dean said, and of course you should get a lot of different people's input on this, but he doesn't see a big recession or a big housing dip coming. To me, the big takeaway for you is if you and your husband feel confident in your particular jobs, in whatever particular field you're in. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Thank you so much. It is very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Please call us again. Nisu in Monroe, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hello, Nisu.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First time.
What you got?
Just a comment in the question you had earlier about, you know, the announcement of not being shareholder focused. I think in the long run, obviously it is about, you know, profitability, and it goes in twofolds, right? There's a demand by consumers of companies being ethical and being socially conscious. So if you have those kinds of products up and down your chain, you know, you're going to draw the consumers. So a lot of small companies have shown that there is a demand for these kinds of products. So that's why they're making the shift. And on the worker side, you know, if you have a happy worker and you take care of your employees, whether it's work-life balance or whatever you're offering that a lot of workers are demanding now, they're going to want to stay with the company. They're going to work harder. They're going to be, you know, more loyal. They're not going to just say, okay, it's, you know, 5 o'clock, I'm stamping out and I'm done. You know, they're going to be more committed and engaged with the company, and that's great for you know, hopefully running more efficiently and reducing cost in the long
sure.
run.
Sure, but Nisa, let me jump in and ask you a question as somebody who runs a business, and I know you said that tries to be socially and environmentally conscious. What's new here? Because if the story that's broken out as a big news story after this announcement that 200 chief executives, including the leaders of Apple and Walmart and JPMorgan Chase, say they want to redefine the role of business in society to be more socially conscious with respect to all those stakeholders, their employees and their customers and the environment. Isn't that what they always have said for decades and decades, that they would say, yes, there's got to be a balance here. Of course, we're not going to be mean to our workers. Of course, we're not going to go out and pollute the environment, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you hear this as new?
I think it's not that you're outright mean to your employees, but, you know, if you look at, like, what Google, Facebook, they haven't existed for, you know, 50 years, right? Some of these banks have been around for so long. It's work hard, keep your head down, and you'll be rewarded eventually. Now it's like, you know, especially someone, younger folks, the millennials, right? They're the talent they want to attract. They don't want to work till midnight and not see their family and, you know, just hoping that they'll make it to the top one day. And I think a lot of the talent that's going into a lot of these tech companies and startups and in younger companies, relatively young companies, they're able to draw these folks who are like, look, 6 o'clock, I'm going to go home. I'll go have dinner with whoever, and then maybe around 9 o'clock, I'll I'll log on and do my work. And I think it's become more like, does it matter how many hours you spend in the office, mm-hmm. or is it more important how productive an employee is?
Nitsu, thank you so much. Thank you. Call us again. And Dean, kind of to his point, there's a great article in The New Yorker by Andrew Marantz right now where he's writing about all these executives from the big Silicon Valley firms going to the Esalen Institute out in California, the spiritually oriented retreat place, and they're soul searching in ways that they haven't before. Like, we thought we were doing things that were pro-social by making these tech companies, and you can think of what the big ones are, where our products are so sticky and people want to pay attention and they can search things and buy things and connect socially with the people in their lives. You know, we thought those were good things, and now everybody's telling us, wait, you're complicit in Brexit and Russia and everything else. And there's maybe some kind of corporate reevaluation going on.
Well, they're responding to social pressures, and that's always been the case. And, you know, that's a good thing. But, I mean, I think it's important to realize it's coming from society. And, you know, just to give you a really concrete example that's had a huge impact, when I was growing up, when there was a strike, a company basically shut down. They might operate with a skeletal staff. Beginning with the PATCO strike, when you had the air traffic controller strike, Reagan was president, and he broke the union. He brought in military controllers, and that was a real sea change, because it suddenly became acceptable for big companies. I remember Greyhound Bus Company, Eastern Airlines, they began bringing in replacement workers. So if you went on strike, you risked losing your job. That wasn't done. It was always legal. Anyone could have done that, but it wasn't done just because that was considered so unethical. So it wasn't that suddenly employers became bad guys. It was that, you know, Reagan did this. He was president of the United States. So, oh, we could do this now. So it's, you know, it's not that I think CEOs are particularly bad people, but they're responding to society. So it's, of course, good if they go, oh, you know, Facebook does some bad things. Is there a way we could clean that up? But it's not just that Mark Zuckerberg or any of these other people suddenly, you know, had a conscience. It's that, you know, people are raising this issue and they're worried about, okay, is Facebook going to be able to survive? Because a lot of people aren't regulated. They want to break it up. They want to change the rules so that it won't be profitable. So they have to recognize that, and that's, of course, a good thing.
Tyrus in Vero Beach, Florida. You're on WNYC. Hi, Tyrus.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a financial advisor, as I told your screener, and you mentioned financial advising earlier, and I actually have been fielding more calls from clients asking about, oh my gosh, I'm hearing so much stuff about the talk of recessions, and what we tell our clients is the average recession lasts about 22 months, and what is important for people is understanding risk. So if somebody is concerned about recession, and they are, that means they're perhaps more conservative than others. Then what's really important is to have a good cash balance, some liquid assets that you can get at. So if a recession does happen and your stock portfolio or whatever is depressed, then you don't have to sell off in a panic. And obviously that applies to people with a fair amount of assets in order to have a cushion. But we tell people, as a rule, we tell people that one of the first things they should do when doing any financial planning is to actually build up a cash balance for that. And I urge my clients to do that.
Mm-hmm. To be ready for the possibility of a downturn. So, Dean, when a macroeconomist and a financial advisor get together over a beer, what do you talk about?
Something other than the economy. No, I would agree with that point, though, but if you're in a situation where I realize a lot of people don't have any money, so it's kind of a moot point, but people who do have some assets, it's a good idea to have some of them be liquid. My mother is retired, as you might imagine. She's somewhat older than me, and she has retirement wealth, and I just encouraged her to be in the stock market, to take much of what was in the stock market and put into a money market fund, just so that it would would be liquid. I don't know the market will go down, but it certainly could. And I just thought that was a good cautious move.
I'm relieved to hear your mother is older than you. Because if she wasn't,
it's true.
We think the inverted yield curve is weird. I'm going to give you, as we wrap up here, a chance to fact check the president on something. Here's what he said this week about the state of the American wallet.
Our consumers are rich. I gave a tremendous tax cut, and they're loaded up with money.
They're loaded up with money?
He's thinking of his friends. You know, as we know, the tax cut went overwhelmingly to wealthy people, and they did very well with it. Most people got little or nothing. So, yes, his friends probably are loaded up with money. That's not the case with the vast majority of people in the country.
And I don't think most Americans in his white, non-college educated base experience themselves as loaded with money. Most people won't hear that clip, but I wonder if people politically would feel like, well, if he wasn't out of touch before, he's out of touch now. But we will leave that there as a question, as we thank Dean Baker, co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He also blogs about media coverage of the economy at his blog called Beat the Press. Dean, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.